agenda is a public hearing on House Bill 2246. Ms. Seville.
House Bill 2246 would modify the conditions under which a parent or guardian may give alcohol to a person under 21 years of age. There is, oh, just for note, the fiscal statement is not yet complete, so we cannot work this today.
Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Ignalski. I'm the Regulatory Services Division Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm here to testify in support of our bill, House Bill 2246. House Bill 2246 proposes to amend ORS 471410, Section 2. This statute it deals with purchasing and providing alcohol to a minor. This statute states that only a parent or a guardian may give or otherwise make alcohol available to a person under the age of 21. It does not specify under what conditions. This bill would propose to add to that only in a private resident and only in the company of the parent. The reason why we're proposing this is that you have another statute, 471-430, which is MIP, which is a minor in possession of law, which is more specific. And it says that a parent can only provide a minor alcohol in a private resident in the presence of their parent or guardian and with parent or guardian consent. You have two statutes that are a little bit in conflict with each other because one says that a parent can give their minor child alcohol, but it doesn't say where. So in theory, you could have somebody say, well, I can buy a beer for my kid at a restaurant because it says I can give it to them, but then if the child takes possession of that alcohol, they would be immediately in violation of minor in possession law. We're just trying to put these two together and clarify when a parent or guardian can give alcohol to their minor child. The public and some parents and legal guardians have questioned us and have interpreted this to mean something different. And we are just trying to take the confusion out of the conflict between these two statutes and put them together so they do make sense. Because even if a parent gave their child alcohol outside of their home, they would be immediately in conflict with the minor possession law. So amending ORS 471410 to state that a parent or guardian may give or otherwise make alcohol liquor available to a person under the age of 21 only if the person is in a private residence and the company of the parent or guardian will put it in more compliance with the statute dealing with minors and possession. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
It makes sense to me that you can't be giving your kid alcohol at a licensed establishment, but I was just thinking of people on a picnic or something might want to let their kid have a beer, and they would not be allowed to do that under this. Is that correct?
Under your minor possession law, Chairman Parker, the 471430, you would be in violation of the minor, would be in violation of minor possession. And so that's where the conflict is that you have one that says you'll have a violation of minor in possession if they take it any other place other than a private resident in the presence of the parent. And so it's confusing. So we're asking to kind of put the language together so they make sense for all that read either one of the statutes when minors can be given alcohol by their parents and where.
And it can only be in a private residence.
Yes, under this Chairman okay. Bucket, that's what it would say.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions?
Where the assumption's always been.
Anybody? Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, do you know if there's any type of religious ceremonies that alcohol is used in?
Still
wine?
Paley? I don't know. I mean,
well,
I grew up Catholic.
Outside the home.
Absolutely. I mean, you do. I mean, you have Catholic faith as well as the Lutheran faith that do that, and so you got a little bit of conflict going on there.
Is there a religious exemption anywhere in the law? Do you know?
Chairman Barker is just looking. I believe there is a...
So I've never heard anybody getting arrested for MIP at communion.
Hey, you know.
Well, we'll take care of that.
Yeah.
So it was the first though, Mr. Chair.
That's right.
I don't see it off the top of my head, just skimming through this, but I believe there is an exception for religious ceremonies. But looking at this right now, I do not.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Meyer?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. Representative Krieger, you need to stop thinking of my issues. So frequently this session, we are here in opposition to this change in law because of the religious infringement possibilities. There are practices, I can imagine a synagogue having a Seder where as part of the Passover Seder there is alcohol that would not be at a private residence. You've noted some others. Also, the statute to which the proponents spoke of, 471.430, which they say they're trying to tie this with, one, that's a Class A violation. This is a Class A misdemeanor. So this is a significant change to the punishment. And also, that statute does have the religious exemption, but this does not. This at best appears unnecessary. I haven't heard any evidence of a problem. Parents should be able to practice religious freedom with, and when appropriate, in religious ceremonies, be it in a private residence, in a building that is part of a business, you know, as I said, a religious institution, should not have to worry that they're not only potentially engaged in a violation, but here a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay. If this were a violation like the other one and had a religious exemption, would you be opposed to it still?
Chair Barker, that would certainly improve, although I, you know, because the religious exemption is the critical piece. However, I always like to ask, where's the problem that you're trying to fix? And you know, is this a sufficient enough problem that we want to go after parents in those cases where it's not religious and it's not in a residence that it might occur? And I think for parents it would be very difficult to understand the scope of the law in terms of where it's safe and where it's not.
Well,
it would certainly be an improvement, and at least it would bring it in line and address some of our concerns.
The other witness was saying that the confusion surrounds it where somebody in a restaurant thinks they could order a beer for their kid or allow them to drink, which of course they wouldn't in a license.
Chair Barker, they may be confused and they may ask for it, but I'm assuming that the server will not allow the drink to be served to the minor. And if the minor's assuming that the server in the business has a problem that they need to do enforcement, regardless of what the law says, I can't imagine the server knowingly serving a minor alcohol.
Ms. Meyer, I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is, as I've been aware in a couple of situations where, like, a bottle of wine is ordered and then in a restaurant and subsequently served, and there's potential issues that occur in that regards, because then you've got a situation where you've got the parent, you've got the server, the dynamics can be rather dicey, wouldn't you agree?
Chair Barker, Representative Siegler, yes, but do we want to make that a Class A misdemeanor for a parent who might let their 20-year-old... You know, I have to admit, I come from the generation where I was grandparented in, and I was in New York, so it was permissible at 19, at 20, and 21 for me to drink legally in this country. But, you know, we do have that dynamic, and the question is whether you want to make it a crime.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yeah. If the issue of the religious exemption and the level of classification of the offense were clarified, I think it makes, doesn't it, wouldn't you agree it makes some sense to bring it into, I mean, consistency with the minor in possession, so you don't have any question about the who's and why fors?
Chair Barker, Representative Siegler, yes, and I would just want to make sure that the language is clear that it doesn't matter where that religious practice
is going.
So that's carefully written, so not to...
It could be just about anywhere. In any religion. You're right. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I hope you might take just a few moments to see if you could talk to the OLCC and see if that would, if or they could talk to you,
right.
Since they want to make the change. And if you would help them come to something that you could agree to.
Chair Barker, I'm more than happy to. Of course, this current law is already a Class A misdemeanor, so I doubt they're going to want to change that scheme. So I don't know where the sense of the committee is if they intended to raise.
We're not working it today.
Right, but to raise the level to a Class A misdemeanor, or if that's also. I gather the religious exemption is a concern, and I hope that the Class A misdemeanor is a concern, but I'm happy to work with OLCC if we have some guidance on a sense of the committee on the sanction.
Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on 2246 and open a public hearing on 2262.
House Bill 2262 authorizes the trial court to reinstate charges previously dismissed pursuant to a plea agreement if the defendant withdraws the plea, has a conviction overturned, or obtains post-conviction relief. We have statements back from both revenue and fiscal. There's a minimal expenditure on fiscal and no revenue, so it's ready to be worked.
Okay. Michael Slauson and Diana Vitolins. You can go ahead in either order. Just identify yourself for the record, please. And go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slauson. I'm a senior assistant attorney general in the Oregon Department of Justice in the Criminal Justice Division. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2262. House Bill 2262 deals with plea negotiations. As I assume most of you know, most of the criminal cases are resolved through plea negotiations. And our courts have held that plea negotiations are basically like contract negotiations. So in that sense, traditional concepts of contract law apply to plea agreements. To achieve plea agreements, both sides have to make concessions. So what the defense concedes is they're not going to require the state to go to a full-blown trial. And the state will make sentencing concessions and reducing the sentence, or, as is relevant to our discussion today with this House bill, often will dismiss counts. In some cases, after a plea agreement is reached and the defendant is convicted, the defendant may be allowed to withdraw the guilty plea or the plea of no contest, or the defendant's conviction could be overturned or vacated or set aside. If that situation does occur, the state might find itself in a position where it cannot proceed on the dismissed counts. That might happen most often because those counts are now barred by the statute of limitations. And under a case called State versus Dinsmore, our Oregon Supreme Court has held that a trial court in that situation cannot reinstate those charges. Under House Bill 2262, if a defendant's plea agreement is vacated or set aside or reversed or withdrawn, under that bill, the state can refile the dismissed charges to put the state back in the same position it would have been at the outset when the agreement was originally reached. It basically applies the basic rule of contract law. That's the same situation you would be in any other kind of contract situation. I have kind of a case example for you guys. In this particular case, I can't say that the state lost the opportunity to pursue any charges because it's still too new, but it's a case that was handed down on February 12th this last week by the Oregon Supreme Court, and it's State versus Baker. I don't even have a full cite for it yet. But I was just reading the facts the other day about this case. And in it, the state charged the defendant with 21 counts of second-degree sexual abuse and 54 counts of incest. And as we were sort of talking about how the state will sometimes dismiss charges to reach an agreement, that's what they did in this case. Pursuant to the plea agreement, the defendant pled guilty to 5 counts of second-degree sexual abuse and 5 counts of incest. So you can see that's a significant drop in counts. The trial court sentenced the defendant to 180 months in prison on the 5 counts of sexual abuse and sentenced him to 30 months on the 5 counts of incest. So after the parties have reached that agreement, they're all in agreement before the trial court, or after that point, and now what has happened is the defense has sought to overturn that conviction on the basis that his sentence is unconstitutionally disproportionate to what he was actually convicted of, which is those five counts of sexual abuse in the second degree and the five counts of incest.
Yeah.
Now, I can't say in this case what's going to happen down the road because we're not there yet, but you can imagine what could happen here is if down the road the court agreed with the defendant, we would have gone from a total of 75 counts down to 10 counts if those counts were, the counts that were dismissed were later barred by the statute of limitations. So that's what House Bill 2262 seeks to address. It just basically puts the parties back in the same position. If the court were later, like say for instance in this case, to find that that sentence was disproportionate, just puts us all back in the same position so we can renegotiate the case or move forward to trial.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Chair. What was the reasoning of the court in the Dinsmore opinion for reaching a different conclusion about what current law is?
Representative Barker, Chair Barker, Representative Garrett. In Dinsmore dealt more with the contractual negotiations that the parties had in that case. And so in that case, it dealt with what is called a conditional plea agreement. So the defense and the state agreed that the defendant would agree to the sentence and conviction, but would be allowed an opportunity to appeal a legal issue up to the Court of Appeals. And if the defendant won on that legal issue, then they would go back down, the defendant would be allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. And so the court said under that contractual negotiations that you had there, there was no contractual agreement that the state could reinstate any kind of dismissed charges, what the state did, and there was no authority for the court to do it on its own.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Slauson, you talked about the example where there were 54 charges and they only went forward with five. Are there other reasons why the prosecution might have not have gone forward with those other cases beyond just the kind of the bartering of the plea arrangement?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, that would happen, I guess, in a number of cases. I don't know about the fact specifics in this case. I can tell you that a prosecutor would not ethically charge a case, or is not supposed to ethically charge a case, unless there was a reasonable belief that there could be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt on the charges. So, but in any case, it could be maybe a victim left or something like that. We don't know all the bases.
Ms. Seville, could you address that point at all?
If I understood the question, it was there. Why might there be reasons why they wanted to take just a plea to five instead of doing all of them? And I can tell you in many circumstances it's the fact that you might have, and I'm not sure about this case, but you might have children. I mean, these are very, very sensitive cases, and you are sparing a victim or numerous victims having to come up on the stand, face that person, talk to a jury about something that pretty much is a big dividing line in their life between normal and then the rest of their life. And so that's a huge point. And I think Ms. Williams can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's a huge factor in crafting these plea agreements when you're facing 50, 30 counts and going down to something like five or six.
Mm-hmm. So could I ask you a question about that? So let's say it was not a child sexual offense, if it was something else. Might the prosecution decide to just take its, you know, five strongest cases and make those part of the plea arrangement as well?
They may, but I would say in my experience, and I have not personally tried a sex abuse case. I've helped, but I have not tried. So from my experience and what I've talked and seen, would not do so without consulting victims and talking to them and seeing the status of the charges, what they want to do. I mean, ultimately, the prosecutor would make the decision, but the victims, I think, would be involved.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vitolins, and I'm the Crook County District Attorney, and I'm here to say on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association that we support House Bill 2262. And I can give you a brief example of a case that I actually tried. I did not try the original case, but I came to the DA's office in Polk County, and it was a case where the defendant had robbed a store, robbed a market, gone to a dairy farm, stole the farmer's car, did some other damage, and then ended up trying to kill a police officer, but he wasn't successful, drove off and wrecked. 10 years later, I got the case because it came back from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals with a reversal of our convictions, and it was a negotiated conviction, so I had never been involved in the first case. The second time around, we were barred from the unauthorized use of a motor vehicle by the statute of limitations and other things, which prevented us from getting restitution for all of the victims. We had our original robbery charge and the attempted murder of the police officer, but the other cases we'd negotiated and as part of that agreement had agreed to put restitution in that original judgment, and that was all gone when it came back.
And that's all I have to say.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. Ms. Gehlmeyer, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer, and I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. House Bill 2262 looks short and simple and sweet, but actually it addresses a lot of different plea scenarios and different kinds of plea bargaining all in one paragraph, and I would submit that they, quite frankly, require separate analyses, and they don't all fit within this one bill. OCDLA would agree with the first set of provisions in said Section 1. It says, notwithstanding ORS 131 and the other statutory provisions, if a plea of guilty or no contest is withdrawn under ORS 135.365, then in that instance the court may reinstate any other charges that were dismissed. We would agree with that. As to that provision, ORS 135.365, that's withdrawal of a plea of guilty made prior to judgment, meaning prior to sentencing. So what that says is a court may at any time before judgment, upon a plea of guilty or no contest, permit it to be withdrawn and a plea of not guilty substituted therefor. So if there were five counts, defendant decides he's going to plead guilty to two, three of them being dismissed, hasn't been sentenced yet. At some point, the defendant changes his or her mind, says, you know what, I want to withdraw my two guilty pleas. The judge may or may not allow it. But if the judge allows it, and it's prior to sentencing, the other three charges that would have been dismissed upon sentencing are allowed to be reinstated and prosecuted. So that at that point, if the plea is withdrawn prior to sentencing, they would then move forward with all five charges. Then House Bill 2262 goes beyond that, though, and it says if a judgment of conviction, meaning there's now sentencing, based on a plea of guilty or no contest is reversed, vacated, or set aside on appeal by a court of appellate, competent jurisdiction, then the court may reinstate any charge. This is where we'd have to separate between conditional pleas and non-conditional pleas. Prior to the conditional plea statute, which was enacted in 1999, the only way in which a defendant could appeal based on a plea is if the sentence was unconstitutional or in excess of the statutory allotment allowed by law. So in that instance, suppose there were five counts, defendant pled guilty to two, proceeded to sentencing, and the judge gave an unconstitutional sentence on those two counts, in that it exceeded the statutory maximum allowed by law. The defendant could appeal that, and it would be the only basis upon which the defendant could appeal that plea. My sentence exceeded that which was allowed by law. And if the appellate court agreed, he'd come back and he would be sentenced pursuant to what would be allowed by law. What House Bill 2262 would do, it would change that. It would say, well, you're not just going to come back down and be sentenced based on those two convictions that you had. It would also then allow the resurrection of those three counts that had been dismissed. That's a radical change of the way we've been doing business here in the state for many, many years. Then you also have to distinguish the conditional plea. The conditional plea, again, that statute was enacted in 1999 for a reason. It was sponsored by the Oregon State Bar's Criminal Law Section because prior to the conditional plea statute, again, the only basis upon which a defendant could appeal his or her plea is on very narrow grounds, i.e., it was unconstitutional or my sentence exceeded the statutory maximum allowed by law. What that meant was is that if a defendant had five counts and did motions to suppress and lost, but felt that he or she really had viable grounds to suppress evidence and so wanted to preserve that for purposes of appeal, he or she would have to push the case for trial because that's the only way in which that motion to suppress would be preserved for the purpose of appellate review. So the Oregon State Bar comes forward and says, you know, that really is an excessive waste of judicial resources. Either you have a jury trial or you have a bench trial or something called a stipulated facts trial, but let's just do this a different way. And basically they borrowed from a paradigm used in federal law, too. Let's allow what's called a conditional plea. And a conditional plea is a special kind of plea. It now allows you to have to plead guilty to certain counts and reserve the right, in writing, to appeal those motions to suppress. This is a good thing because this statute, again, it was proffered by the Oregon State Bar in 1999, it saves judicial resources. It allows the parties to bargain amongst themselves. I've got a great motion to suppress. You don't want me to push this up on appeal. You don't want to go to trial. Everybody can bargain what their interests are, and so then they can amass their bargain. Dinsmore, the case of State versus Dinsmore, dealt with this conditional plea. Again, five counts, defendant does a motion to suppress, pleads guilty to two under a conditional plea. The bargain was such, it was framed, and it was framed by the district attorney, you can plead to two counts under a conditional plea, I'll allow you to appeal to the Court of Appeals, we will dismiss the other three counts. Defendant went up, prevailed, the court agreed, your motion to suppress should have been granted, came back down to the trial court, wanted to go to trial on those two counts. The state wanted to resurrect the three that had been dismissed. Trial court agreed, we're going to resurrect those three. They go to trial, he gets convicted, goes up on appeal again. He says, you know, I never should have had to defend charges on those other three counts. I should have only had to go to trial on those two counts. That's where the Supreme Court of Oregon agreed. They said, look, the bargain is the bargain, and don't confuse the bargain with the conditional plea statute. You could have framed the bargain any way you wanted to, but the way you framed it was, you can plead to two counts, you can go up on appeal on two counts, and I am dismissing three counts. And the Supreme Court said, if the prosecutor didn't want to have those three counts completely off the table, then he or she could have structured the negotiations differently. The bargain could have been framed such that you can plead to these two counts, but if you come back, you're waiving your statutory limitation rights, and we can reinstate the other three. So it's a matter of whether or not the bargain satisfactorily scooped up everything that the state ultimately wanted to see happen. So again, there's multiple different kinds of pleas, multiple different kinds of plea negotiations and how they're structured. This House Bill 2262 picks up a lot of them. In one instance, we would agree, but as to the other two, it's a radical change, and I would suggest that the Supreme Court got it right in Dinsmore. I'd also suggest that this language in 2262 would essentially undo conditional pleas. It was a good idea for them to be enacted in 1999, and I would suggest it would be a mistake to undo it now.
In the example that was given where somebody had set a plea and they had restitution and that's wiped out, how would you address that in a sense of justice?
Chair Barker, I have to apologize. In some instances, I was actually talking to the lawyer next to me about something, and so I'm not sure I heard the
example. The example was that somebody had pled to a couple of things, but part of that agreement was restitution to several other people. It was kicked back out. The defendant prevailed, and therefore it eliminated the agreements to restitution, so the victims were not left whole. I think I
So, Chair Barker, I'm struggling still to understand this. So, was it a conditional plea or no? It was just the defendant pled, and there was restitution obligation affixed to.
They said, "Well, kiss these off, but you need to make restitution
for the dismissed charges."
For the dismissed charges, not kissed off, dismissed. Thank you. And so, then when it came back down, he was found not guilty was reversed on the main portion, then the rest of that didn't apply either of the part of the plea bargain, so then the victims were left holding the bag.
Chair Barker, in that instance, do you know the basis for appealing the convictions upon which...
I could find out real quick.
Okay, that might control my analysis. Yeah.
Ms. Vitolins? Vitolins, I'm sorry.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, it was ineffective assistance of counsel was the reason for the reversal of the convictions, and so he pleaded guilty to a couple charges with the understanding that restitution would be paid, and then the statute of limitations had expired when the case came back in 10 years.
May I ask some questions, please? We want to get it clarified.
Okay, thank you. So there were several counts, and the defendant pled guilty to some and then agreed to restitution for the dismissed counts.
That's correct.
Okay. What was the basis for appealing the counts of conviction on the plea?
Ineffective assistance of counsel. I guess it was post-conviction. It was appealed, affirmed on appeal, and then came back post-conviction all the way to the Ninth Circuit. And it came back 10 years later.
The defendant had ineffective representation on two pleas that he pled
to. That's correct.
Thank you.
No, it was a general question, and you don't need to. You don't actually. I'm not.
It's a wrinkle I hadn't considered, to be honest.
Representative Stigler.
Yeah, Ms. Mars, I just to be real clear here, there are certain circumstances. Is the only circumstance under which you think that this would be appropriate would be basically the plea prior to sentencing, the withdrawal prior to sentencing. Is that the only circumstance?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, definitely always when the defendant withdraws the plea prior to sentencing, all the existing charges, still remain.
That's sort of currently the standard anyway.
It is.
Right.
And then I would submit that under Dinsmore with the conditional plea, if the bargain is framed, if the contractual bargain is structured such that the defendant agrees upon prevailing on appeal, I would waive any statute of limitations rights or any other complaints to the resurrection reinstatement of the...
So that's going to lead me to my next question.
Okay.
You're anticipating my question here. How often, in your experience... Well, you talked about judicial efficiency and the effectiveness. I mean, being able to pare these things down, obviously. We don't want every potential motion, everything going to the courts. We're trying to...
Right.
Right. So how likely would it be that a defendant is going to enter into those kind of conditional plea agreements under the ordinary course of things? The scenario, and let me try to frame it a little better, the scenario you were describing was really more in light of where there's a particular issue that has come up in the process of this. But isn't it true that by far the vast majority of plea agreements don't have those kind of conditional circumstances attached to them, that you're sort of horse trading, okay, I'm going to do this in exchange for this?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, I think I understand what you're saying. Conditional pleas are not the majority of pleas. Yes, majority of pleas are simply straight out, I'm pleading guilty to two, you dismissing three. In those instances, you almost never see an appeal.
Right.
And that's the
point. But in those circumstances, I don't know all the circumstances in Dinsmore. I mean, but essentially, I mean, I understand your point about if it's a conditional kind of plea, you can sort of set that up in those rare circumstances where a conditional plea actually occurs, which is a minority of the cases, because you're anticipating something else out there.
You're anticipating appellate review.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, in some way, shape, or form.
Yes. And Dinsmore was a conditional plea case. Yes.
But in circumstances such as what Ms. Vitalin's described here, this thing that goes on down the road, and like ineffective assistance of counsel is not the thing that you generally anticipate happening. I mean, it happens, but it's not the kind of thing. So then you're left with a situation, for instance, in that kind of situation, or a myriad of other circumstances that post-conviction can creep up. So then you really have sort of this category that's stuck in the middle. They're not really conducive to a conditional plea. They're not, you know, one of the circumstances that you would necessarily anticipate. So you really don't have a remedy. Wouldn't you agree?
Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler, I was trying to think through something that you said, and now I'm not so sure
what your question at the back end of it.
Well, I guess
my point is this, that you know, every circumstance isn't conducive to a conditional plea. I mean,
correct.
Under those circumstances, I mean, if that was the situation, potentially it could create its own set of really voluminous litigation. I mean, if we were going to say, okay, in order to avoid this, then what the prosecution is going to do is set up a conditional plea every time they enter into a plea agreement, which could get to be really dicey.
Mm-hmm. Well, Representative Barker and I'm Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler. I would agree with you that, I don't know my percentages, but it's
right.
A rare day when you have a conditional plea, because you first would have had to have had pretrial hearings that someone won, someone lost, and the defendant wants
right.
to preserve his or her arguments on appeal. That doesn't happen all that much, but it does. In most instances where it's just a flat-out plea, no one's anticipating any appellate review. What's confusing to me about the other scenario is, it's not a basis to challenge on appeal the effective representation of counsel if you've had a plea. If you've had a plea, you can appeal the plea based on limited provisions,
sure,
and then you jump over into post-conviction relief, which
right.
is, to be honest with you, a wrinkle I hadn't considered.
Right. That's what I'm, I mean, but that's...
You would be able to, I mean, there's nothing that would prevent you. If I had incompetent counsel that told me to plead guilty, hopefully I would have a remedy.
Well, that's
post-conviction.
You would have to appeal, and then that would be denied because you didn't have a basis to appeal, and then you'd jump over into post-conviction.
But Mr. Chair, my point was, you do have those circumstances where it gets tossed back to the court, and you effectively don't have a remedy.
Yeah.
You don't have any way to address this issue of trying to reinstate the original set of charges.
Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler, were your comments then directed to the post-conviction relief proceedings?
Well,
there are other,
any of the other potential possibilities. Not that they're often used, but they do get used, and then you have those situations.
Okay. And Chair Barker and members
anyway.
Of the committee, what I do want to point about 2262, it's not limited to conditional pleas. It doesn't even cite the conditional plea statute. It lumps together all pleas.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that it does a whole lot, some of which is unintended, and I think there are a lot of unintended consequences.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, it's my understanding that we're not going to be working this bill today, correct?
We could work this today.
Yeah.
I would love an opportunity to read Dinsmore, which I have not yet had. And actually, I have a couple questions just before I read it, just so I can clarify my analysis when I read that case. So I suppose question number one is, Should this legislature repeal Dinsmore? But I gather you're saying that there's an additional question, that because the statute does more than just repeal Dinsmore. Can you, as I read this decision, I understand exactly what questions I should be thinking of. Can you clarify the sort of questions presented for me?
Yes, thank you. Chair Barker and Representative Barton. I think the analysis should start with Dinsmore. So the first question would be, did Dinsmore get it right or did it get it wrong? I would admit they got it right. What Dinsmore is saying, what the Supreme Court said in Dinsmore is, don't confuse the conditional plea statute with the terms of your bargain. You didn't phrase your bargain the way you wanted your bargain, so don't confuse the two. So the question, first question is, did Dinsmore get it right, and should we undo Dinsmore? Secondly, does 2262 do more than just affect the Dinsmore decision? I would submit that it does.
Follow up, Mr. Please. Chair. And it, would it be possible, for example, let's pretend that I come to the conclusion that Dinsmore got it wrong. I know your contention is that Dinsmore got it right and that 2260 does more than just reverse Dinsmore. Let's pretend that I come to the, I say Dinsmore got it wrong and we want it, but that you're correct in that 2262 does do more than Dinsmore. Could you possibly think of some kind of amendment to this statute or something that could more, that could essentially tailor it more narrowly just so that it, what it really is doing is reversing Dinsmore?
Oh, if all it were to... Thank you. Chair Barker and Representative Barton, if all the state wanted to accomplish was to reverse Dinsmore, then they should cite a completely different provision. They should cite ORS 135.335(3).
Can you repeat that, please?
Yes, 135.335(3). That is the conditional plea statute. And basically it says at the end of it, a defendant who finally prevails on appeal may withdraw the plea, and all you'd have to do is tack on a provision, and the state may resurrect charges previously dismissed. Chair Barker, may I inquire, is there anything that I can do? I know this is confusing. I'm wondering if there's anything else I could do, if I could write a position paper or something. I don't know.
It'd be helpful.
Yeah, Ms.
Aye. Yeah.
But everybody equal to discuss and address all the issues.
Ms. Meyer, just to clarify, is your only real objection to this this bill the fact that you see that it includes conditional pleas?
No, I think it goes further than existing law from lines 5 through 8, the second half of line 5. I agree that if a plea of guilty or no contest is withdrawn under ORS 135.365, charges may be reinstated. But that doesn't say anything new. That's existing law.
So even with even focusing on PCR and issues like that, would you say that your position is you have a concern with whether or not charges, I mean, everything can be reinstated if someone's granted post-conviction relief?
Chair Barker and counsel, I have to honestly say I haven't thought that one through. I mean, PCR is something that if you're appealing a plea because you want to preserve your argument that you had ineffective representation, I'd have to think about that.
Okay, I'm not going to work this today. We need to give it a little more thought, and if it comes down to the DAs have to make the conditional deal and everything, and the people don't want to do it, then maybe we'll just, maybe it will take some more court time, but so be it. And but in the meantime, I'm just going to close the public hearing and just thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Hope we can possibly figure something out to accommodate the concerns. Next item on the agenda is House Bill 2363. Open a public hearing on 2363. We will not be working this one.
House Bill 2263 would extend the kidnapping statute so that kidnapping in the first degree would include kidnapping a person under the age of 12 with the purpose of committing a sex offense. In making that kidnapping in the first degree, it would also remove the necessity of having the enhancement factors that physical injury or that the person was terrorized. So that would remove that from this portion of Kidnap 1. We have, if I can have a moment, the revenue statement is in, but again, we do not have a fiscal, so...
Mr. Slauson, Ms. Vitolin's again, please. Am I saying it right? Vitolin's. Sorry.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slauson. I'm a senior assistant attorney general in the Oregon Department of Justice with the Criminal Justice Division. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2263, which amends the crime of kidnapping in the first degree. Before I turn to the specifics of 2263, I thought I'd just take a moment or so to discuss current Oregon laws that relates to kidnapping. In Oregon, we have 2 degrees of kidnapping. Second-degree kidnapping defines the basic offense of kidnapping. And in Oregon, you commit the basic offense of kidnapping when a person with the intent to substantially interfere with another's liberty without authority or consent moves that person from one place to another or confines that person in a place where they're unlikely to be found. First-degree kidnapping is basically that basic offense of kidnapping in the second degree, but it's aggravated. And to aggravate it from second-degree kidnapping to first-degree kidnapping, there has to be one of 4 factors present. First, you have to commit kidnapping for the purpose of getting a ransom. Second, for using the person as a shield or a hostage. 3, to cause physical injury to the victim. And 4, for terrorizing the victim or another person. So that's the difference between their base offense of second-degree kidnapping and first-degree kidnapping with those 4 aggravating factors. In 2006, the legislature increased the penalties for first-degree kidnapping when the kidnapping is committed in furtherance of the commission or attempted commission of first-degree rape, sodomy, or unlawful sexual penetration, and the victim is a child under 12 years of age. That law that the legislature passed is known as Jessica's Law. It was passed, was named in honor of 9-year-old Jessica Lunsford, who was kidnapped, raped, and murdered by a person who had a history of sexually abusing children. It's actually based on a law out of Florida. What House Bill 2263 does is addresses a disconnect between Jessica's Law, which enhanced the sentencing for kidnapping in the first degree with the actual elements of first degree kidnapping. As I had mentioned, to elevate basic offensive kidnapping up to first degree, you have to have one of those 4 factors I talked about, which is different than the sex abuse against a child that Jessica Law requires. So what House Bill 2263 does is line those up by including as elements in first degree kidnapping committing the kidnapping in furtherance of the commission or attempted commission of one of those sex crimes against a child under the age of 12. So practically speaking, what is the current state of the law now that we have Jessica's Law without this change? If a person were to abduct a 12-year-old or 11-year-old child for the purpose of kidnapping that child, that's only second-degree kidnapping. That wouldn't be first-degree kidnapping. Jessica's Law would not come into play. To get Jessica's Law into the game, the state would have to prove one of those additional 4 factors, which is actually kind of difficult in most cases. Courts have held that you have to have an independent intent to cause physical injury to the victim. That one could apply, but there's a lot of cases with sodomy and other types of offenses where you might actually have an independent intent to cause physical injury to the child. And terrorizing under that standard would not fit either, because it would be difficult in many cases for the state to prove that independent intent to terrorize beyond the actual act of sex abuse. So in short, what House Bill 2263 does is to give full effect to Jessica's Law, which the legislature passed in 2006. Thank you for hearing my testimony. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions?
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Again, my name is Dinah Vitalins, and I'm the Crook County District Attorney, and I'm here simply to say that the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports this bill. That's all I have.
Okay. And so the present time, somebody kidnaps with the intent with an 11-year-old or younger, it's second degree, unless these other things happen. This would make it first degree if they're kidnapping them with intent to commit the sodomy or rape or whatever they're going to do, the molestation.
Chair Barker, that's correct.
Yes. So you'd still have to prove that factor to make that work.
Because what this bill would do is add those as elements of first-degree kidnapping. Correct. So you'd have to prove that the person kidnapped with the intent to commit one of those crimes.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you. Ms. Meyer and Whitney Boyce.
Thank you. either or just identify yourself, please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm Gail Meyer, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. If the kidnapping statute, the underlying kidnapping statute, were a hallmark of clarity, which it is not, we would not be opposing this bill. It makes good sense to create a distinction between kidnapping a minor and kidnapping an adult for the purpose of a sexual assault. The problem we have is not with that distinction. The problem we have is with the underlying elements and lack of clarity of the underlying elements for the kidnapping statutory scheme in of itself. And so I'd also point out as I'm making my comments that the leap in sentencing from kidnapping 2 to kidnapping 1 of a minor, 12 and younger, is extreme. Kidnapping 2 is 70 months. Kidnapping 1 of a minor to commit a sexual assault of less than 12 years of age is 300 months. So you've got a multiplier of 4 here from your sentence that goes with respect to this change. I'll be going through in my comments in a moment is to point out the reasons why we are concerned with the lack of clarity of the underlying statutory scheme and language of the kidnapping statutes. But the bottom line is this. Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is going to be making an application to the Oregon Law Commission that the Oregon Law Commission accept a review of the kidnapping scheme as one of its next work group issues. I've talked to the executive director of the Oregon Law Commission. I've talked to its current executive director, I forget the name of the other title, but two of them there, and they would agree that to review the kidnapping statutes and the problems that it's engendered in the appellate courts in the state is something that's within the core of its mission to do. And I would suggest that if the committee or the criminal ODAA or the DOJ also wanted to join in that application, it would enhance the thought that the Oregon Law Commission would actually accept this. Suffice to say that there's really no statutory scheme in our criminal code which has caused more confusion than the kidnapping statute. And when you think about it, you know, most crimes just sort of have a certain clarity to them. I mean, with burglary, it's enter or remain in a building. And with forgery, it's an unauthorized signature or a fake instrument. With a sexual assault, it's sexual contact without consent or permission. But kidnapping can so frequently be incidental to the commission of some other crime. And so taking a person from one place to another or confining them against their will can be conduct that's subsumed within some other criminal act. So every sexual assault, by its definition, requires a restraint. And every robbery, by definition, requires some restraint. And so then the question becomes, in the appellate review of these cases, is the restraint or the taking from one place to the other merely incidental to the commission of some other offense, or does it really constitute a separate offense of itself? And if you read the Kidnapping 2 statute, it states that a person commits the crime of kidnapping in the second degree if, with intent to interfere substantially with another's personal liberty and without consent or legal authority, the person A, takes the person from one place to another, or B, secretly confines the person in a place where the person is not likely to be found. Again, there's been no other crime that's engendered the kind of appellate review than these kidnapping statutes has engendered. In 1980, in the Garcia case, the Supreme Court says, you know, we have virtually no guidance based on this statute as to whether or not there's a minimum amount of distance that one might need to be escorted or in a minimal amount of time in order to constitute substantial interference. The biggest case that wrestled with this whole issue was in September of 2004, and in that case, the Supreme Court attempted to give some clarity to the whole statutory scheme. It involved domestic partners where, in the course of a domestic assault, the defendant dragged the victim from the bedroom into the living room where he assaulted her. The assault was an assault 4, which is a misdemeanor. But then the government also charged a kidnapping 1, which is an A felony, B because in the course of the kidnapping, it was done for the purpose of committing having physical injury. And so the question before the Supreme Court was, was this an independent act of kidnapping, or was this simply an incidental part of committing this misdemeanor assault? For the lawyers on the committee and for the non-lawyers on the committee, the court had to engage in analysis under the PGE review. And the court said, you know what, the language that's actually used in the statute does not help us understand what it means. And so therefore, we're going to have to not look just to the language of the statute. We're going to have to go behind the language and get into legislative intent. That's generally the first sign that a court is struggling with language in a statute when they're saying the language alone isn't going to help us here. We have to go behind that. We have to look at the legislative history. In the Murray case in 2006, it was an instance where the defendant had shoved the driver of a car over into the passenger seat of the car. And the court said, well, you know, there's no exact amount of difference here, but we're going to have to just say as a matter of law, that's not substantial movement. Just shoving someone from a driver's seat over to a passenger seat of itself is not substantial movement. But then it looked different to the court, to the Court of Appeals anyway, in the Walsh decision in 2006. In that instance, the defendant had taken the victim from the ground and put her into the trunk of the car. And the court said, you know, that's not that far either, but boy, that looks and feels different because it's a different kind of place. There's not very much innocent purpose for putting someone in the trunk of a car, so we're going to say that that act alone constituted kidnapping. Now, that case, that Court of Appeals case, has been accepted for review by the Supreme Court, so we don't know what they're going to be doing with that. And then it's not as though the confusion has been cleared up at all, because just recently in July of 2008, the court in Adnor Zorzenko, I can spell it if you wish, also was wrestling again with the question of how much aspiration, how much movement from one place to the next, or what time frame, how long can you constrain someone against their will, constitutes kidnapping. The bottom line is this, that the court's struggling. I remember when the very first day of hearing here, you had Justice Kiesler and Judge Schuman from the Court of Appeals here, and they talked about how sometimes the legislature can speak plainly when you say, hello, Court of Appeals, we're talking to you, you're talking to you. But I would submit that with the wrangling and the wrestling that the court's been doing with the kidnapping statute and having to say the language won't help us in the statute, we have to go behind that to look at the legislative intent. In this instance, I think the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court is saying to the legislature, hello, hello, we're struggling here. And so I would submit to the committee that the best course of action, instead of exacerbating the confusion of the statute and prolonging its language, that we just sort of take a halt. And as I say, OCDLA will be submitting an application to the Oregon Law Commission that it accept review of the kidnapping statute as one of its new work studies. It would enhance the likelihood that they would accept review of that if it were joined by perhaps the committee here or any other entity who might have an interest in implementing the statute.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Whitney Boyce. I've been a lawyer for 23 years. I've been a criminal defense lawyer for 21 years. For the last 17 years, I've worked exclusively in private practice. I started out as a criminal defense lawyer, I think, in 1991 at the Multnomah County Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, and I was there for 4 years. For the last 17 years, I've been in private practice. My law partner is Ron Hovett. He was a federal prosecutor for years before he became a criminal defense lawyer. One of my other partners was Judy Snyder. She was a district attorney in Multnomah County for many years. In 1981, I was Assistant Sergeant at Arms of the Oregon State Legislature, assigned to the Environment Committee, or Energy Committee. Anyway, I am here in opposition to House Bill 2263, and my comments come after Ms. Myers analysis that the kidnapping statute is truly viewed as being ambiguous by many practitioners. The problem with that is in our system, which is an adversarial system, if the prosecution or the defense has too much power in any given situation, it puts things out of skew. And when you have a potential sentence of 300 months and you have legislation that is ambiguous, it puts a disproportionate power in the prosecution, and I'll explain what I mean by that. In a case when a client comes to me and they're charged with a 300-month sentence, a mandatory minimum sentence, and they look at me and they say, you know, I've got a very strong case, but I'm looking at 25 years in prison. It is the exceptional person who's going to go to trial. Most people, the innocent included, will negotiate. And that means they will negotiate on a 25-year sentence to somewhere probably, if they have a strong case, around 5 to 8 years. And so what I'm saying to you is that this bill puts a disproportionate power in the prosecution, and I think before we do that, the definition of kidnapping really does need to be cleared up, and I would be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Okay, thank you. The courts have not held kidnapping to be unconstitutional, and you talk about a unbalance of power. It's the little girl that's being grabbed by some monster. The legislative intent of Jessica's law was to see to it that some scumbag that molests a child under the age of 12 rots in jail, 25 years in lifetime monitoring. And I was chief petitioner on the petition trying to get that before the special session do it, so I know the intent of that. We're getting confused, I think, to spending too much time. I don't mind if somebody reviews kidnapping and takes a look at that, but this law is to bring Jessica's law in line with the kidnapping statute, and I have no problem, I mean, of seeing somebody who's kidnapping a child under 12, and I don't think you do either, of spending 25 years in prison. Maybe you do. I'm not saying that, but I don't have any problem. It was intended legislation in the special session to see to it that somebody who's going to grab a child is going to molest them and too often kill them, or at least ruin their life after somebody's been molested like that, serve 25 years. This brings that into line. And, you know, I'm going to certainly support that today. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You took some of the words out of my mouth, although perhaps more colorfully than I would have used, but the but not to my disagreement. I will say that I don't think the fact that it might be 5 to 8 years, it's in the negotiation, makes me think that we should make it easier on the accused in this scenario. It makes me think, well, why is it only 5 to 8 if we really meant 25? So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I wanted to ask, just to be clear, Ms. Myers, is if we enact this bill, that does not disturb. It may put you in a difficult, you know, slightly more difficult circumstance, but it doesn't disturb the ability of the law commission or some other, you know, less biased party to look at the underlying rules, correct? Is that right?
Chair Barker and Representative Smith, that would be true.
Okay.
I don't
mean to be disrespectful, but, you know, it is, we'll have lots of difficult issues, and in this, you know, 10 politicians here, you know, abuser versus abused, we're going to be on the side of the abused every single time, and so how many times we sort of fire our bullets of dissent to try to make sure we make these laws a little bit, you know, make sure fairness is applied, I think really matters, and so I think we want to be careful which ones we really spend our energy upon. But anyway, I'm done.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a slightly more technical question after such colorful language previously. Bullets of dissent, by the way. I think it's a beautiful one, Representative Smith.
My question for you. First of all, after your review of the kidnapping jurisprudence, I see what you're saying. Clearly, the courts appear to be struggling with the statutes as implemented. And I'm certainly not opposed whatsoever towards the Law Commission reviewing that. I'll be happy to mention it to Professor Dobbins, who I think is the executive director and former colleague of mine and Representative Garrett. However, I did want to push back in terms of the bill in front of us today, 2263. I'm just not convinced that the language here actually will exacerbate the problems with the statute itself. In fact, it seems, if anything, to be clarifying. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, do you disagree? I gather you disagree. And do you see what I'm seeing, Ms. Myers?
Chair Barker and Representative Barton, my very first comments to the committee were, if the underlying kidnapping statute were a modicum of clarity, we would not be opposing this bill. And so I think what you're talking, I view it as a pyramid, and we're stacking up onto that pyramid. And I think your comment is, what's wrong with the top piece of the pyramid? And my statement to the committee is, not much. My concern is the underlying basis for the kidnapping, the confusion of the kidnapping statute. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did, Ms. Okay. Myers. And Mr. Okay. Chair, although I intend to support this bill, I'll be happy to discuss with members of the Law Commission that this might be a suitable project for further review.
And we're not working it today either because we don't have the fiscal back, but... Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I just want to be real clear here, too. First of all, the existing statute on the books, kidnapping 2, that this jumps from, has been on the books since 1971, correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, I would believe so.
Yep. Okay. Yep. And I understand your argument regarding that there has been a lot of appellate... You termed it as turmoil, or a lot of appellate review of the provisions of the statute, the aspartation aspects, that kind of thing. Wouldn't you agree that in circumstances that are factually based, which are a lot of criminal statutes have the premise of? I mean, a lot of our criminal laws are not. They're not black and white. They're based on factual situations, i.e., why we have a trier of fact to view that set of factual situations to determine whether they fall within the four corners of the statute, that this is not unlike a lot of those situations as far as appellate review.
Chair Barker and Representative Stegler, I would agree with you that there might be confusion as to the contours of the reach of certain statutes. Like, for instance, the harassment statutes had a lot of adjudication. I think what's unique about kidnapping is that it can be subsumed within the conduct of actually committing another crime. So I'm thinking of the Woolleyat case where he took the victim from one room to another. It was a misdemeanor assault,
right.
But then they alleged a kidnapping 1, which is an A felony. That's what's unique about kidnapping, is that it can be incidental to committing another.
Understood, but again, it's factually based. I mean, it's the circumstances of the particular case and what can be argued from that. The point I'm trying to make, I'm not trying to argue with you, but that there are, that the criminal statutes are rarely, I mean, it would be to your detriment, quite frankly, as a criminal defense lawyer, if our statutes were so clear in black and white that you never had room to argue about anything.
How could that be? It is. I mean, I think everybody's in agreement that it'd be good to take a look at that statute. And I know of many times in my law enforcement career when we'd have an arrest and we'd be deciding what to charge somebody with, and kidnap would come up and they'd say it doesn't apply, it wasn't far enough, just these same things you're bringing up. And then regardless of what we decided at the police station, the DAs would take another look at it and so on. So those are valid points, but the clarity around Jessica's law, it seems to me to be very clear. Any other questions? And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. And close the hearing on 2263. Open a public hearing on 2264. Explanation.
House Bill 2264 authorizes civil actions against persons who bring false claims and receive benefits from a state agency or otherwise knowingly defraud a state agency. It also creates a false claims recovery revolving account in a general fund to support DOJ's actions to recover amounts paid for fraudulent funds. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we do not have the fiscal statement at this time.
Okay. Mr. Boss and Mr. Dubanovich.
Yes, Chair Barker. My name is Keith DeBanovich, members of the committee. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General, John Krover. With me is Fred Boss, who is the head of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Department of Justice. We are here to speak in support of House Bill 2264, and it is a, we believe, fairly straightforward measure, and the purposes for the bill are equally important in this time in our economy. First, our goal is to help preserve the tax dollars that we are all unfortunately spending and will be spent in a greater amount in the next coming couple of years. And secondarily, we want to make sure that that money is spent on the things that you members of the committee and the rest of the House and the Senate decide that the money should be spent on. And last but not least, we want to deter fraud on the taxpayers. As you all know, $175 million of state money will be spent over the next couple of years. And unfortunately, that makes it a ready opportunity for fraud on state government. What 2264 does is authorize the Department of Justice to bring civil actions against any person or entity that submits a knowingly false or fraudulent claim to the state of Oregon. The bill is very similar to the Federal False Claims Act, and what it essentially does is allow us to pursue individuals or companies that submit an invoice that they know is false or that they submit with reckless disregard of the truth. We have no particular targets in mind, no industries that we are focusing on. Quite to the contrary, it is our intent to focus on the areas where you legislators decide to spend the public money, for it is in those areas that, unfortunately, the fraud will occur as we spend our money. So with that, I would like to turn to Mr. Boss, who will address the mechanics of the bill.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I am here to testify in support of House Bill 2264. As a Special Counsel Domenovich testified, this is a bill that allows the Attorney General to file a civil suit against those who obtain or attempt to obtain money or property from the state using false or fraudulent information. A person would be liable if they knowingly present or cause to be presented a false claim. The state need not show that there is an intent to defraud on behalf of the defendant. The state also need not show that it relied upon the false statement. The state can recover up to treble damages for the amount received for the as a result of the statement. However, there is also a safe harbor. If the person who is the defendant cooperates with the Attorney General's office with the investigation, they only have to repay those benefits obtained. The Act would also allow the Attorney General to recover the cost of investigation and attorney's fees. The federal government and 28 other states have similar False Claims Act. Examples of the use that we have seen in our practice would be, for example, state employees submitting false time records. We had a while ago a state employee in the state hospital that submitted timesheets that he was working two 8-hour shifts, when in fact he was working only 1 8-hour shift. This happened over a 2-year period of time. The supervisor signed off on the records. Employee was caught. There was an issue under just simple fraud about whether or not the supervisor should have relied upon those, knowing that perhaps that employee wasn't working two 8-hour shifts. Other examples are computer software contractors that submitted invoices having met certain deliverables when in fact those deliverables had not been met and having been paid. This bill, House Bill 2264, would allow DOJ to protect the taxpayers' money and obtain a refund in those circumstances.
A couple of concluding comments. There is no fiscal impact to this bill. for any prosecution that we pursue. We will recover attorney fees as a result of the fines and penalties that we obtain at the end of the prosecution. Secondarily, we have met with representatives of the industry. We will probably be meeting with them either again at the end of this week or the beginning of this week. They have raised some questions that we intend to address with them. Last but not least, we want to make clear that it is not our intent, nor does this bill allow us to pursue claims against people who make mere mistakes. This is a bill that is targeting people who, as the bill defines, have actual knowledge of false or fraudulent claims. They act in deliberate ignorance of the falsity or in reckless disregard of the false or fraudulent nature of the claim they are submitting. So this bill is targeting people who know that they are submitting a false invoice to the state of Oregon and want hard-earned taxpayer dollars. And we intend to pursue claims against those people.
Thank you. In a case, there's a bill I've seen that hasn't been heard yet, that I don't know if you're familiar with the tax offset provision of the PERS retirees, public employee retirees, work that was done prior to 1990 during the time when employees were promised they wouldn't have to pay state tax. People who worked during that period who are now retired or going to retire have a certain portion, they get the tax offset to make up for the fact that they are paying Oregon tax. This bill would say that if you don't live in Oregon, you're not paying taxes, you won't get that anymore. So somebody in order might want to defraud the state by saying, oh, I live in Oregon, when they don't pay taxes. Would you be able to pursue something like that under this provision?
Seems like we could. Whether we would or not would remain, it depend upon whether the person knowingly tried to avoid paying taxes or not.
I don't know about PERS, but in another pension system, people are required to say I live where they live, so then they would. Okay, thank you very much. Any further questions? Representative Krieger.
Just wondering, only the claims type thing we kind of in discussion. What about the 24 million of false claims that we found in the Oregon health plan, people lying about residency and those types of things, and all the social programs are designed to help those who are really needed, and we have other people trying to qualify falsely and receive those benefits.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, indeed, we would intend to pursue people that make repetitive false claims. It would not be worth our time to chase after somebody that made a one-time accidental application for benefits. But if somebody habitually, frequently, and repetitively seeks benefits when they are not entitled to them, or if they facilitate their neighbor or spouse to obtain benefits when they're not entitled to them, this bill would allow us to pursue them and obtain additional remedies against them.
Thank you.
Chair.
Thank you. Representative Stegler.
You used the term that you were meeting with some members of the industry. Who's the industry?
There have been a number of people. We've met with the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition, members of the Oregon Medical Association, and pharmaceutical representatives.
And just if you could briefly enlighten us as to what concerns they've alerted you to within this legislation.
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, I don't think I can briefly describe them. They're fairly extensive. I've got about five pages of concerns. Some of them are not, they're more complicated than necessarily lengthy. And some of them I think that we can easily resolve. Some of them require a little bit more substantive evaluation, so it would be too difficult for me to get into them. I believe there's a representative of industry that's going to be speaking here today.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Is it your intent to work with them to come back with proposed amendments?
That was Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, that would be our proposal.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question. You just cited some examples of, I'm wondering why we can't, if somebody continually fraudulently took on the government for claims, what stops you from going after them today?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, as we've already heard, the facts determine what claims we may or may not have. for example, we may not learn about the fraudulent claim for years and the statute of limitations may bar the claim. We may also find that contractually they fulfilled their obligations so we don't have a contractual claim against them. What this statute does is provide us one additional tool to chase after somebody that has made a fraudulent claim to the government, even though we may not have a tort or contract claim.
Follow up, if I may. And then do you have examples you could bring before this committee of those types of claims that you would go after that you could not go after today, but you would go after if this law was passed?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, we'd be happy to provide committee with that information.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dubronovich and Mr. Boss, would you accept a friendly amendment? Did your group consider going after retirement benefits of those people who have committed a felony in their job? This representative for two sessions has tried to get this body to look at the fact that if someone's convicted of a felony while they're conducting their job and earning benefits from the taxpayers, they should not be getting those benefits in retirement.
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnett, I think before we decided to accept your amendment, I'd first want to find out whether they're already covered by this, and if they are, then there wouldn't be a need for the amendment.
Thank you.
Representative
Gary. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The treble damages provision, I assume, is the biggest new tool in the arsenal here, right? That doesn't currently exist for any fraud action you'd bring or contract claim you'd bring.
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, you're absolutely correct. That is the biggest tool that we would have in our arsenal.
Thank you.
With that tool in your arsenal, would you expect that you would call me up and say, we've discovered this, and is this, $5,000, you're going to owe $15,000, how about paying the $5,000? I mean, would this aid you in reaching settlements without court?
Chair Barker, as Mr. Boss already indicated, indeed, the statute contains a provision where if a company cooperates with us, we would not seek treble damages. All that we'd need to do is to refund to the state the fraudulently obtained monies. It is indeed our goal to simply obtain that kind of cooperation so that the state is paying for what it's entitled to.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2264 and open a work session on House Bill 2175. Ms. Seville.
House Bill 2175 has with it now -1 amendments that came in today. The bill as it was originally brought to the committee is part of the Walsh Act compliance bills, and this particular one addressed the Oregon residents who are convicted or adjudicated out of state are not required in that state to be supervised, who come back to Oregon, and this measure would require those persons to register again as part of Walsh. This amendment actually does not address that particular issue. It addresses the current requirements for the current registration requirements. It addresses both juveniles and adults, and I believe Ms. Beatty can address that. We do not have the fiscal back on the -1 amendments. Okay. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, last one. Sorry.
Someone should have stopped me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We'll go ahead and do this. I'm going to go back to the other bill real quickly. People should have spaced them out.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach, and I'm representing the Juvenile Rights Project, and we actually have brought the -1 amendments to provide further clarification in statute about the process for notifying someone that they need to register in Oregon. And this is related to a case that's come up for the Juvenile Rights Project, but unfortunately I don't have a staff attorney here today to go into any detail with the committee about that.
But these are the amendments you brought forward to
yes.
correct the
correct.
Problem from before. Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vi Beatty. I'm the manager of the Oregon State Sex Offender Registry with Oregon State Police. These amendments basically address current practice in place by Oregon Youth Authority, Juvenile Department, and DOC. I cannot speak on behalf of those agencies, but this just clarifies what their current practices, as I understand it, is. for persons who compact or transfer their supervision from one state to another or to Oregon.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. We can't take this to a full vote today, but we can admit the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move we accept Dash 1 amendments into HB 2175.
Representative Wisnant moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2175. Is there any objection? Any discussion? Hearing none, so ordered, and close the work session on House Bill 2175. I'm going to reopen 2264, and I apologize to Ms. Hebb and Mr. Gardner, who were signed up on the witness list and outer space or something. I missed that.
I think you took a few of us with you. So.
The balance of power question. Mr. Gardner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. As was indicated by Mr. Dubanovich, he and Mr. Boss graciously allowed us to participate in a meeting at the Department of Justice to voice some of the technical issues that we identified as a part of this draft. It is our intent to attempt to come to consensus on at least as many of those as we can. I can outline briefly what the issues are, and in general they fall under the category of attempting to make this statute track as closely as possible the federal tort claim, the federal equivalent, the Federal False Claims Act. That's important because many of the bad acts that occur involve programs that are partially funded by the state and partially funded by the federal government. Medicaid's a classic example, but also some of the programs under the recovery legislation that was just passed by the Congress, highway funding and the like. And I can also give you some examples, if you would like, of some of the technical issues that we think are in this legislation, if that would be helpful, Mr. Chair.
You could, if you're going to have a work agreement, maybe that would just...
That's fine, Mr. Chair. Okay. We have a work group constituted. Great. The other participants in that include the Hospital Association, the Medical Association, and I think there will probably be a couple of others that that will want to participate in that work group.
And thank you very much for your effort to get that resolved.
Yes, appreciate thank you, Mr.
That.
Chairman.
Ms. Hebb.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center here today, and I want to express general support for the goal of the bill today, but I do have some concerns on behalf of recipients of public benefits and wanted to put those on the record and would hope that I could participate in the work group with the idea of achieving consensus. There are overpayment processes that are set up within the Department of Human Services to address when benefits are paid out when they should not have been. There's also a program to address intentional violations, and we feel that those are sufficient to address those concerns and worry about the additional treble damages provisions and just sort of firepower behind the Tort Claims Act or the Claims Act that's proposed here for that population. We have a number of people who either have language difficulties or cognitive disabilities, and often there are very technical requirements with respect to reporting requirements and other issues in the administration of public benefits, and so we would really worry about the ability to prosecute people for claims for issues that were not, in fact, intentional and knowing. And so that's where our perspective is, and hopefully we can work out.
Thank you. I hope you will work with them. And, of course, it's the civil, you know, this is a bill to take civil action, and I don't think anybody wants to see somebody who's desperately poor who makes a mistake then having to be told they have to come up with triple damages. So it'd be thank you very much for your willingness to participate. Representative Martin.
Mr. Chair, I gather you perhaps want to expedite this process. I'll suspend the questions
on.
If you're...
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
I do have some questions. Actually, both of you... I have questions, I suppose, of both. Number one is I don't understand why it is necessarily critical that this Claims Act mirror its federal counterpart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, it will facilitate prosecution and civil prosecution, not criminal prosecutions, and will also allow the resources, which are in limited supply, on the part of both the U.S. Department of Justice and on the part of the Oregon Department of Justice, those to be used most efficiently, because I think it is safe to say that even with the best efforts at enforcement, these agencies are going to be stretched thin, and so I think it's useful to have resource sharing between the two.
To clarify, you want this Claims Act sponsored by the state DOJ. You want it to mirror the or parallel the federal counterpart,
the substantive
to
provisions.
Assist them in the implementation execution.
That's essentially
of this
what
bill.
We'd like to do. Yeah.
Thank you. And a follow up now to you, if I may. Just based on the act, I recognize your concerns with the treble damages provision, but just based on its testimony and the way I read this, as you know, there is a significant issue with under-enforcement of these of claims of this nature, which is perhaps thus the nature of the treble damages provision. I cannot imagine, just in actual application, that the state DOJ is suddenly going to start going after people with cognitive disabilities or the disenfranchised in our society, as opposed to systematic offenders who could, A, did it knowingly, and B, could be proven to have done it knowingly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, and I agree, and I think that's been expressed as the intent. Our concern is if that's the intent, the statutory authority is much, much broader than that, and so we're worried about creating any disincentive. Also, I think we have seen in our experience representing or working with individuals that oftentimes an agency may have a perception that a person's application was intentionally misrepresentative, and then after investigation, once we got involved and were able to look at the facts, have dropped the fraud allegations because they discovered a cognitive disability or they discovered a lack of misunderstanding. Oftentimes, you know, caseloads are high. There was evidence in these cases that I'm thinking about, in two out of the three, there was evidence in the agency's record that there was a cognitive disability, but I think it just didn't get noticed, and so and there was a prosecution and so or an investigation. And so just because of that, we worry about this larger sanction and this great breadth of authority. Absolutely agree with the larger intent of the proposal.
Representative Stigler.
Just as sort of a follow-up to Representative Barton's comments in that regard, I couldn't be more in support of, I mean, not picking on those who shouldn't be picked upon, but there are those in the, I would say, the public sector benefit, other public benefit sector who abuse the system, quite frankly. And I would hate, and I say this sort of as a provisional in the negotiations, I would hate to see that group of folks taken out of this this potential set of civil actions and sanctions altogether. I would disagree with you that the current state of the law under the fraud enforcement part of the Department of Human Services is sufficient to take into consideration those kinds of circumstances. I'm pretty well aware of what they are, and I think they're probably very inadequate, I guess is the best way to put it. So I would encourage us not to, you know, not to take those folks out. I would agree with Representative Barton that if DOJ suddenly starts going after those folks, then you have a problem. But
and Chair Barker and Representative Stigler, and we would absolutely, we're not standing up for people who are repeated and intentional and willful knowing violators at all.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. But you made the comment early on in your testimony that you felt that the current existing statutes under the Department of Human Services were sufficient to deal with the cases that you're talking about. And I'm just here to say that I think that there's a reason for including them in this process as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I apologize for having you sit through the other bill. Close the public hearing on 2264. It opened a work session on House Bill 2336. Go ahead. You're on.
House Bill 2336, again, this bill allows for convictions under another jurisdiction's statutory counterpart to be entered into evidence in certain criminal proceedings. We heard this back on the 6th of February. We received the fiscal and revenue statements. There's no revenue and no expenditure.
And do you want to just explain just a little further what this is?
Okay. Under there are Generally speaking, you cannot introduce a person's previous convictions except in certain circumstances. If they're within 15 years, or you can bring in misdemeanors if they have to do with, I forget the term of art, but basically if they have to do with your honesty, moral turpitude, yes, thank you. If the theft, perjury, things of that nature. Under a special class of crimes, and I want to make sure I say this correctly, I believe it has to do with, let's see, mostly I think DV cases, you are allowed to, anybody who testifies, they can be impeached with prior convictions having to do with assault in the fourth degree, harassment, attempted assault for, and strangulation. It's only in specific crimes that those prior convictions can be brought in. All of this statute does is allow that if there's a statutory counterpart, let's say if a person has been convicted in Idaho of the statutory counterpart to assault four, that when they testify, that actually can be brought out, even though it's not Oregon's version of the assault four conviction. And statutory counterpart is looked at, and it's typically, they look at the, it's the intent and...
The
elements are the same. So it's not, you can't say in one that it's, you know, reckless, but in Oregon it's intentional, and that's a statutory counterpart simply because they're both called assault. It's not that case. If it's going to be a statutory counterpart, it would be knowing and knowing, or intentional and intentional.
Okay. Any questions?
Can I ask?
Yes, please.
I'm looking at my bill file, and I think I had some notes, but they maybe didn't make it all the way back in here. I can't remember if there was any controversy around this. Was there any testimony in opposition?
I don't have any.
DA Bradbury testified at the time, and I didn't make a note. He was the only person in there. Wasn't any opposition.
That same amount of my notes, so in the opposition. I'll accept the motion to move this to the floor with a due pass.
So moved.
Representative Stigler moves House Bill 2336 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wizen?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Is anybody, what would anybody like to carry that? I'll carry it. Be the carrier. We have two more items. We have two more bills to introduce as committee bills. By voting for these, is no way indicates that you're in support of them or that you will or won't support them when they come to the committee or on the floor. We need to adopt the drafts. The first one is LC 2909 relating to corrections.
So moved. Submitted as a committee bill.
Representative Wisnett moves that LC 2909 be adopted as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
We need to vote on that, or can we just declare it?
We need to call the roll.
Okay.
So ordered. With no objections. The next item is LC 3369 relating to products of individuals with disabilities.
LC 3369 is a committee bill.
Representative Wisnett moves LC 3369 be adopted as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, so ordered. Any further business before the committee today?
Mr.
Yes.
Chair, I just had a question. The amendment to the dash one amendment to 2262, was that?
We have not.
Did we? Oh, okay. We didn't discuss that, or that wasn't part of it. Okay.
No further business before the committee is adjourned.
It will be as part of the.
It will be.
Okay.
Yeah. We didn't adopt or do anything with it.
Okay.